Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Good evening. Primary elections tonight in five states, Missouri, Michigan, Kansas, Arizona, and Washington. Polls are closing just now in all or parts of three of them. Abortion is on the ballot in Kansas, and supporters of the former president's election lie are running in Arizona and elsewhere. Three Republicans who voted to impeach the former president are all facing tough primary challenges from candidates that he's supporting. In Arizona, State House Speaker Rusty Bowers, the conservative Republican State House Speaker who refused to help overturn the election and testified before the House Select Committee, he is also facing opposition backed by the former president in his state Senate race. Some of those very same candidates are also being supported controversially by Democrats hoping to run against more extreme opponents in the fall. All of this with inflation and fears of a recession as a backdrop, President Biden's recent legislative actions and foreign policy decisions on the table, and midterm elections now just 98 days away. CNN's John King is over the magic wall tracking all the important races and trends. Let's check in with you first. So, John, Missouri polls are just closing. As you know, the former president caused a lot of confusion in his Senate endorsement of two people named Eric, both running for the same office. How is that race shaping up?
Yeah, Anderson, the fact that we're talking about Missouri is actually the story in the sense that this is a retiring Republican incumbent, Roy Blunt, in a midterm election year where the wind is at the Republicans' back. This should be a safe seat hold for Republicans. But as you noted, the former president decided at the last minute to get involved. What did he mean? Eric Greitens, the disgraced former governor who had to resign because of allegations of misconduct. He now wants to be in the Senate. Did he mean Eric Greitens or did he mean State Attorney General Eric Schmidt? Well, Donald Trump trying to be cute here in a very important race. Republicans are not happy with this. Both Eric Schmidt, by the way, the attorney general, and Eric Greitens, the governor, back to varying degrees Trump's big lie. So that's on the ballot again tonight. But the Democrats believe if Greitens can win this nomination, they might have a shot of picking up this seat. Think of the gift that would be. A 50-50 United States Senate. Republicans have a chance to take control. The Senate is the most competitive battleground if you look through governor's races, House races, et cetera. If the Democrats are in play in Missouri after tonight, that is a gift for the Democratic Party, plain and simple.
Michigan, obviously another important state for midterms in the next presidential cycle. What are some of the key races there?
And so obviously you have a gubernatorial primary there as well. Governor Gretchen Whitmer is up. Let me get to that one here and bring this up here. And again, Trump came in late in the governor's primary here, endorsing Tudor Nixon. Again, Ryan Kelly, another Republican candidate, was here in Washington on January 6th at the United States Capitol. Tudor Dixon backs the big lie. So if you just think about it again, Michigan always a competitive battleground state. Governor's race is even more important now that the Supreme Court has kicked the abortion issue back to the states. Will the cancer of the big lie continue to spread among major Republican candidates for office? Will Republican voters, after the January 6th hearings, as we get closer to the midterm elections, will there be a snapback? Michigan will be one of the places we learn that.
And obviously Arizona, I mean, there's a lot going on in Arizona. The governor's race has underscored the Trump versus Pence proxy battle among GOP voters. What are you looking there tonight for?
So again, if you bring up the two candidates, Carrie Lake has gone to the full extreme, if you will, of channeling the big lie. She's channeling Trump literally, saying if she doesn't win this primary tonight, it's because there's cheating. If she wins, apparently, Anderson, there's no cheating. But if she loses, there's cheating. That is Donald Trump personified in his preferred candidate in this race. This is Trump versus Pence. Karen Taylor Robson is endorsed by Mike Pence. This is also Trump versus the Republican establishment, the current Republican governor whose term limited backs Taylor Robson. So you have the Trump establishment. But Arizona could, by the end of the night, nominate a full slate of statewide candidates who back the big lie. Again, we need competitive political parties in this country. This is not an anti-Republican statement, but the cancer of the big lie in the Republican Party is on the ballot tonight. Will the Republican Party finally say enough, or will it, in a critical battleground state this year for Senate and governor, obviously in the next presidential election and in every presidential, the next four or five, Arizona's going to be key battleground state. Do Republicans say enough, or do they say the big lie, deniers? Yeah. We will nominate them.
A lot to watch for. We'll come back to you shortly. John, I want to drill down now on Arizona. CNN's Kyung Law is in Scottsdale for us. Do you have a sense of how much of an impact the former president's influence is expected to be in Arizona tonight, particularly in the primaries for governor and secretary of state?
Absolutely. Certainly, it's no secret that Trump is endorsing here, and they know exactly who he is endorsing. A lot of the voters we've spoken to certainly know that Carrie Lake is, as John just described, Trump personified. That is no secret. How it will play out with voters, if there is enough of that Trump base remaining here in Arizona, is going to be the question. That is the question that should be answered by the end of this evening. Remember, 2020 never really ended here in Arizona. This is a place where there was the partisan-led review, that bizarro world of ballot counting on that stadium floor, where Trump forces shortly after the election put pressure on local officials. So there is a true battle here, a war between the election liars and the people who believe in democracy. The people who are going to the polls here at many places, Anderson, right behind me, are certainly understanding that Trump has endorsed. Some say it played a part. A lot of people are saying not as much. So that's a question that we need to wait to be answered.
I assume some of the people saying not as much are the non-Trump endorsed campaigns.
Absolutely. And actually, when I've been talking to a number of sources, I was just telling you about the amount of pressure that was put on local officials. I've spoken to a number of those local officials, and they say really by the end of tonight, they will find out if the party in Arizona, if the Republican Party in Arizona is lost or not. That's what they feel is going to be happening tonight. So there's very little daylight between candidates like Karen Taylor Robeson and Carrie Lake. When you look at the issues like immigration or the economy, there is almost no difference. The big difference is how far they're willing to go with dangerous rhetoric and embracing something that is not true. And then something else I want to mention, Anderson, Secretary of State. Here's somebody who wants to oversee elections. He went to QAnon conventions and wants to completely change the election system to something that's nonsensical and simply wouldn't work if you talk to federal election officials. So that's what's going to be happening. Is this going to go by way of bizarro world, or will the Republican Party pull back and go back to Republican values, according to the many people I've spoken to today about what is at stake here?
King, I appreciate it. As John King mentioned a moment ago, Missouri is home to the two Erics, Greitens and Schmidt, both of whom got the former president's endorsement last night in the Republican U.S. Senate race, or neither of whom, depending on really how you look at it. CNN's Jeff Zeleny joins us now with the latest there. So what are you hearing from campaigns about how this last minute kind of endorsement of the two Erics is going to influence anything, or if not?
Anderson, there's no doubt that Eric Greitens is trying to stage an epic comeback 4 years after he resigned as governor. And that is the question that Missouri voters are going to answer today. Are they still concerned about those allegations? He admitted some of them, having the affair with his hairdresser. He has denied strenuously allegations of abuse of his ex-wife and his child. But this is what has hung over the race for the last several weeks here. And his fellow Republicans have tried to stop his candidacy through millions of dollars in television ads, reminding Missouri voters about all of those sort of details. So Eric Schmidt, the Missouri Attorney General, has really risen in the last several weeks, really taking advantage of some questions about the Greitens' candidacy, but also Congresswoman Vicky Hartzler. She has been in Congress for the last 12 years. She told me yesterday that she would not vote for Eric Greitens if he becomes the Republican Senate nominee. That is what worries Republicans in Washington considerably, because this, of course, should be a safe Republican seat. But in a 50-50 Senate, every seat matters. So that is what concerns Republicans. If Eric Greitens wins tonight, is he going to be able to be a credible general election candidate? We should also note, though, there are 21 Republican candidates on the ballot entirely, so the vote will be split up. Mark McCloskey, who you may remember from St. Louis, he and his wife stopped protesters at their home two summers ago holding a gun. He's also running for Senate, and his yard signs are all over the state here, John. So this does appear to be a three-way contest, at least as Republicans were going to the polls. But the big question, will Eric Greitens stage a comeback or not?
Yeah, that's definitely something to watch for tonight. Jeff Zeleny, appreciate it. Thanks. John King is back joining us as well. CNN senior political analyst Mark Preston, CNN political director David Chalian, and CNN senior political correspondent Abby Phillip, anchor of CNN's Inside Politics Sunday. Abby, let's, I guess, start with Arizona, the election denier.
I mean, there's so much going on here, as Kyung pointed out. But this is a state where I think, you know, Arizona politically right at this moment is probably as far to the right as one could be in terms of this election denying phenomenon. These are Republican voters who go crazy over Sharpies, who did their sort of election audit with a kind of, you know, as people have described it, almost like a fake firm running this audit and finding nothing at the end of the day.
The cyber ninjas.
Yes. They protested outside of ballot counting offices that week of Election Day back in 2020. They are all in on the big lie. And it shows, based on who they are choosing between, from top to bottom on this ballot. So this is a place where that state, the Republican Party, is going all the way to the right. But the state is a purple state. Remember, yeah. Joe Biden won Arizona, and he won it bolstered by a growing population of young Latino voters who are trending more Democratic in Arizona, maybe not elsewhere, but in Arizona. And so this state politically is splitting apart, and Republicans are moving away from the center.
I mean, when you think of, like, Rusty Bowers, a conservative Republican who's been the Speaker of the state, he's now persona non grata among a lot of Republicans in Arizona.
Yeah, and it's not just the commitment to the big lie that Donald Trump tells about the 2020 election. What I think is so important about tonight in Arizona and in Michigan, two critical battleground states, two states that will help determine who the next president is. You have these election deniers seeking positions of oversight of elections. Right. So everything we look at with the January 6th committee, right? You mentioned Rusty Bowers. There were people who stood up and said no. Right? Like, it's going to be country over party for me. That happened in enough places with enough Republican officials to turn Donald Trump's efforts away. Now you have these people who are committed to not just expressing his lies and repeating them, but actually potentially committed to overturning elections that they would then have oversight over if they didn't like the results. That's what I think the biggest danger is in the way in which these Republican primaries play out tonight.
You also have this sort of Trump Pence proxy war. I don't know how significant that really is.
I mean, you know, I think it's more a Trump proxy war against the establishment of the Republican Party. And we use Mike Pence, or we use Doug Ducey, the governor of Arizona, as the person on the other side. You know what's interesting, too, is that we're going to these primaries that are being held in the middle of August right now, the dog days of August. We're not going to see record turnout. We're going to see is turnout by those who are most motivated, who are going to be very likely to be election deniers. Mm. They're more motivated to go out to try to take back and win that seat than it is for these more centrist Republicans to try to defend it and hold back. So when I do think when we look at the results at the end of this week, because we won't get results in some of these races until the end of this week, I think we got to look at really the Republican Party. Has it been taken over by activists that are willing to continue to push the big lie, but are also willing to be involved?
John, in Michigan, there's the key primary challenge for the GOP Congressman Peter Meyer, who's one of 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach the former president after the attack on the Capitol. What are you watching for that in that race?
But you're watching to see if the January 6th hearings, if all this attention on Donald Trump's misconduct, abuse of power, dereliction of duty around that election, does that impact Republican voters? Do they finally decide, enough, we're not going to carry out Donald Trump's grievances anymore? 10 Republicans voted to impeach him. There are 3 contests tonight, Peter Meyer in Michigan, then 2 out in Washington state. I think it is a key question. Are Republican voters willing to support their Republicans who are incumbents, or are they going to carry out Donald Trump's grievances? Do the January 6th hearings, do Donald Trump reemergence have any impact? What is also common about all 3 of these districts, and I just want to come back to the other map to connect it to the points you're discussing with my colleagues, is the suburbs. Those are suburban Republican districts. The suburbs will decide who wins in Arizona. The suburbs will decide who wins statewide in Michigan. The suburbs decide all the close elections in American history. Suburbs made George W. Bush president. They supported Donald Trump just barely, and then they rebelled against him in 2018 and 2020. Suburban America is going to decide what happens in November, and it's also going to have a big voice tonight, suburban Republicans tonight in Arizona, in Michigan, in Washington state, and in Kansas on the abortion question tonight. Suburban America will speak, and the Democrats will be watching Kansas probably more than any state to see what is the message.
Yeah, what about, I mean, in Kansas, abortion really is on the ballot for the first time since the Roe v. Wade decision was overturned.
Yeah, I mean, this is clearly a first test to watch. It is a bit of a kind of you know, hot house of a situation where everybody's attention is on it. And the results have been that in terms of turnout, that there's a lot of interest in this referendum, but there is also a lot of confusion about this ballot initiative. Referendums are often confusing for voters. And so the people who are going to the ballot here are going to have to pay very close attention to what they are voting on, because a yes means basically no to abortion in the state. And that is going to be very confusing to people. But millions and millions of dollars pouring in on both sides of this issue. And I think it will show us a little bit whether or not either side of this can gain the upper hand. And I think also what I'm looking at tonight in Kansas is there are a lot of women who, you know, that you might ask them, they might personally say, hey, I don't support abortion, but they are not comfortable with the state putting in place complete abortion bans. And I think that is going to be something that we learn a little bit more about after the results of this referendum in Kansas.
You also have in Washington state, and John referenced this, candidates, some Republican candidates who are facing primary challenges because they voted in the second impeachment against the president. I mean, does that still have power to bring people out to the polls?
So I mean, it certainly does. I think if you look at two numbers, three tonight, you have Peter Meyer in Michigan, and you have these two Republicans in Washington state right now who all voted to impeach Donald Trump. Then you look at the number 10. Those were the total number of Republicans who had voted. Where are they now? Four are retiring. One has already lost the primary. One has won a primary. Three could lose a primary tonight. And Liz Cheney at the end of August, you know, is heading on a way of losing a primary, even though she has stood up for, for the country above party. So, look, Donald Trump may not be the leader of the party in 2024, but Donald Trump's ideals will certainly drive the party.
David Chalian, Mark Preston, Abby Phillip, thanks so much. Appreciate it. John King, we're going to check in with you later as the results come in. Next, the debate over Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan and the fallout already from it. New York Times columnist Tom Friedman joins us for that. Later, first on CNN, more missing January 6th text messages from the former administration. This time, it's not the Secret Service, it's the Pentagon. More on that ahead. The visit is big, but the potential repercussions are bigger. House Speaker Pelosi and a congressional delegation arriving in Taiwan's capital, Taipei. China responded by announcing live fire military exercises in waters surrounding the island. The Biden administration did not want the speaker to visit Taiwan, but the president stopped short of directly telling her not to. Lawmakers are split, so are many experts, with our next guest, New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman, opposing it. In a piece written shortly before the speaker's arrival, he called the visit utterly reckless, dangerous, and irresponsible. Nothing good will come of it. Tom Friedman joins us now. He's the author, by the way, of countless bestsellers, including Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in the Age of Accelerations. So, Tom, why was this the wrong thing to do?
Well, you know, let me make clear, Anderson, I like Nancy Pelosi. We wouldn't have had the Affordable Care Act without her. She's been a great legislator. But this has the feel to me of a swan song of someone who feels her speakership is ending, maybe her time in politics, felt very strongly about human rights in China and wanted to make this trip now. I get it for Nancy Pelosi. I don't get it for America. She had a right to do this, but doesn't mean it was right to do at this time. What did I feel about it? I feel that we have one overriding foreign policy goal right now, Anderson, and that is to ensure that Vladimir Putin's army in Ukraine is at least stalled and ideally evicted from Ukraine. That is the number one foreign policy issue of the United States. Now, in service of that goal, the Biden administration, through some very tough talks with China's leader, got China to agree not to send arms to Putin. That was very important at the beginning of the war. It's even more important now in month five when Putin's army is really running low on certain munitions. Doing anything right now that would interrupt that Chinese decision or deflect our attention or put us into a two-front confrontation with the world's two biggest superpowers besides us at the same time seems to be just terrible decision.
I want to point out what Speaker Pelosi said in the Washington Post about why she was going. She said, by traveling to Taiwan, we honor our commitment to democracy, reaffirming that the freedoms of Taiwan and all democracies must be respected. And I'm sure if she heard you, she would point out that she went to Kyiv to see and meet with Zelensky to emphasize the importance of the war in Ukraine.
God bless her for doing that. And by the way, she's absolutely right. In principle, we should be doing that. I'm a big believer in we should defend Taiwan's democracy. I think it's very important. I actually agree with the president on that. It's just whether it's the smart thing to do right now, right. Whether you want to put us in a situation where we're juggling two superpower confrontations at the same time. I hope the Chinese will do a sound and light show and then be done with it. But they may not, Anderson. And people seem to forget that China's army is very, very large and very sophisticated. And our goal for Taiwan, as someone like myself who believes in the freedom and democracy of Taiwan and that it should be perpetuated, to me, the right way to do that is by just keeping Taiwan out of the news. Quietly arm them, turn them into a porcupine that China would say every morning, you know what? Not today. Don't want to put my hand on that. And quietly keep it that way. Because who knows, over time, China may change. The situation may change. Every day that Taiwan's democracy thrives is a good day. Grandstanding around that right now doesn't make sense to me.
John Kirby, the NSC spokesman, said that there's no daylight, essentially, between the intent of the speaker's trip to reaffirm American support of a democratic Taiwan and the White House's backing of the One China policy. Substantively, does the trip really change anything? I mean, other than ratcheting up the tension?
Right. Yeah, I think that's all it really does. And believe me, I hope it dies down. Shillin made her point. But if it doesn't, if it contributes to another thing we have to be concerned about, which is, you know, one reason Vladimir Putin probably invaded Ukraine was probably because he felt the window of opportunity was closing, that Ukraine was getting strong, too integrated into the European Union. I think we have to be concerned that what we are telling Xi right now is the chance for any peaceful unification of China and Taiwan is over. And I don't want Xi to conclude, you know what, my window of opportunity for seizing Taiwan may be over. And so I think we got to think about all these different dimensions to the story.
Do you think, if this ends without any major escalation with China, do you think it just fades away? Do you think it hangs over U.S.-China relations for some time?
Well, it'll leave a bad taste, but we have many things we need to do with each other right now, the U.S. and China. We have a broad agenda from trade, obviously, to geopolitics. I hope it dies down. I hope that China, again, sets off a few flares, whatever it does, and by a week or 2 weeks from now, it's all over. But you have to ask Nancy Pelosi, if you're going to do this, what is the strategic context in which you're doing this? What is the strategy? Is it just to make a point, or is it to make a point now in this context? Because I think this relationship between us and Taiwan and the friction it could cause with China is more important than anything going on with Russia. There's just to say we have a right to do that. Yes, we have a right to do that. That doesn't mean it was right to do right now. That's my only argument.
Yeah. Tom Friedman, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, more missing texts related to the investigation surrounding the January 6th attack. This is incredible, this time involving some former top military officials. Details ahead. Tonight, we're learning about yet another agency with deleted text messages connected to the investigation surrounding the January 6th attack. Now, this new revelation involves the Pentagon and comes after, obviously, a similar controversy involving Secret Service agents. In court filings, a watchdog group, American Oversight, says it had tried to get the records of officials, including former Acting Secretary of Defense Chris Miller, former Chief of Staff Kash Patel, and former Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy. There's no suggestion the officials themselves erased the records. According to a joint filing by the government and American Oversight, quote, DOD and Army conveyed to plaintiff that when an employee separates from DOD or Army, he or she turns in the government-issued phone and the phone is wiped. For those custodians no longer with the agency, the text messages were not preserved and therefore could not be searched, although it is possible that particular text messages could have been saved into other record systems, such as email. Now, a short time ago, January 6th committee member Zoe Lofgren says the committee was not aware of the missing text messages and called it concerning. I'm joined now by CNN senior law enforcement analyst Andrew McCabe, a former deputy director of the FBI. I'm wondering what your reaction is to this news, especially coming on the heels of similar revelations about the Secret Service, the Secret Service and the Department of Homeland Security.
So, Anderson, we are now looking at essentially the same coincidence at the Department of Secret Service, at the Department of Homeland Security, and now at the Defense Department. It's starting to look less and less like a coincidence. There is a, in the absolute least case, there's a complete and total failure to abide by and live up to the responsibilities under the Federal Records Act. So, yeah, this is becoming more confounding the further we look.
Zoe Lofgren, who's on the January 6th committee, told us that, to her knowledge, the committee wasn't aware of the erased text messages. Pentagon officials say they only found out today, or they found it only found out today after CNN reported it. What does it say to you about the level of transparency that the committee is actually getting from relevant federal officials?
Well, it's sorely lacking, and that could be the committee's responsibility. Maybe they haven't done a good job in organizing their requests and monitoring those requests that they have outstanding to all the different agencies and the different players that are involved in this massive investigation. But on the other hand, it might be on the agency's side for failing to respond, for obfuscating, for not responding in a fully forthcoming way. But, you know, this is the sort of thing, Anderson, that could be very simply investigated by a competent investigative entity. This is, you know, it's almost unbelievable to think that the Department of Defense doesn't have a system in place to make sure that those people who serve at a high enough level, that their communications, their personal notes, their briefing materials, all that stuff comes under the federal records preservation requirements. It's impossible for me to believe that they don't have a process and an entire staff that's responsible for collecting that material and sending it to the National Archives. So yeah. Did that happen? If not, why?
I should say I misspoke, actually, when I was asking you a question. Zoe Lofgren said that the Select Committee told CNN that, to her knowledge, the committee wasn't aware of these erased messages from Pentagon officials. Not Pentagon officials weren't aware. But I mean, you know, to the argument that, well, look, this is just part of the process. You hand in your phone when you leave government. It gets wiped. Nothing to see here. You're saying for officials at a certain level, the Records Keeping Act should kick in.
Of course. When I started working at a high enough level in the FBI, certainly as, you know, an executive assistant director or as deputy director of the FBI, one of the first things that happened when I took that job was I received a security briefing in which our lawyers explained to me that essentially everything I read, everything I touched, everything I wrote had to be captured and preserved, and that the staff would do that. And all those records were collected in one place and would ultimately be sent to the National Archives. And that, of course, includes all your emails and your text messages. The FBI has a system in place that text messages are actually collected from every FBI phone while the phones are being used. I guess some agencies don't go that far, but it's not that hard to make sure that the Secretary of Defense, on leaving the organization, his phone should get at least mirrored and preserved for all kinds of litigation reasons, for discovery reasons, and of course, the Federal Records Act.
And is it possible to recover deleted text messages? I mean, one hears about deleted text messages being recovered all the time in sort of court cases or in lawsuits, but or officials that were cited in this lawsuit, including former acting Secretary of Defense Chris Miller, former Chief of Staff, former Secretary of the Army, I mean, they're viewed as crucial witnesses to understanding the government's response on that day.
So the effort to recover those messages is certainly worth undertaking. Whether or not you could do it successfully really depends on the technology involved. You'd have to recover those phones, and then you'd have to subject those phones to a pretty detailed forensic analysis. If they were simply deleted, you could probably recover them. If the phones were wiped and the memory was reconfigured in those phones and the process, you might never get them back. So it really depends on what kind of action was taken on those devices. Yeah.
Andrew McCabe, appreciate it as always. Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, 9.5 years of hell. That's how a Sandy Hook parent describes the pain he has endured because of conspiracy spreader and liar Alex Jones. The father says that Jones has tarnished the honor and legacy of his murdered son. More in his courtroom testimony today next. Devastating testimony from two Sandy Hook parents today in an Austin, Texas courtroom in one of several defamation cases against conspiracy spreader Alex Jones. This is the first of three to determine monetary damages for falsely portraying the massacre as a hoax. 2 in Texas, 1 in Connecticut, where 20 first graders and 6 adults were murdered nearly 10 years ago. Testifying in Texas today, the parents of 6-year-old Jesse Lewis. Jones also took the stand late today and got admonished by the judge. He'll continue his testimony tomorrow. We'll have more on that in a moment. But first, the parents' message for the court from CNN's Miguel Marquez.
My son existed.
My son existed, says Scarlett Lewis, the mother of 6-year-old Jesse Lewis, speaking directly to conspiracy theorist Alex Jones in an Austin, Texas courtroom.
Jesse was real. I am a real mom.
In an utterly unthinkable sign of our times, Scarlett Lewis makes the case that she and her dead child are real, directly to Jones.
It doesn't exist that I'm deep state. It's just not true. I know you know that. That's the problem. I know you know that. And you keep saying it. You keep saying it. Why? Why? For money? Because you've made a lot of money while you've said it. I know you're... I mean... I know you believe me. And yet you're going to get... You're going to leave this courthouse and you're going to say it again on your show. You're saying no. You just did it.
On his show today, he raised questions about both Scarlett Lewis and the boy's father, who are seeking up to $150 million in damages.
He is being manipulated by some very bad people. But I'll just say, because I got to be honest, he's slow, okay? And his ex-wife is not.
The man Jones is calling slow and manipulated, Jesse Lewis's father, Neil Heslin.
I was blessed with 6.5 years. He's been gone 1.5 times. And, but I cherish those days. Those years. With Jesse.
In all, families of 7 victims and 1 FBI agent have successfully sued Alex Jones for defamation in 3 different trials taking place in both Texas and Connecticut. Jones testified he was simply trying to get answers to questions that others were asking.
I never intentionally tried to hurt you. I never even said your name until this case came to court. I didn't even really know who you were until a couple years ago when all this started up. The internet had a lot of questions. I had questions.
Based on a separate legal filing, families of Sandy Hook victims allege Jones is using bankruptcy laws to shield tens of millions of dollars from any possible liability. Miguel Marquez, CNN, New York.
Lots to discuss. Joining me now is Elizabeth Williamson of the New York Times, who is in the Austin courtroom today. She's the author of an extraordinary book called Sandy Hook, an American Tragedy and the Battle for Truth. Elizabeth, what happened in the courtroom today after the judge left the room?
It was an emotional day, to say the least, Anderson. And at the end of that day, after the judge went back to her chambers, Alex Jones approached Scarlett Lewis and Neil Heslin, Jesse Lewis's parents, shook their hands. I think Scarlett offered him a bottle of water because he had been coughing throughout his testimony. And he was telling them that he was sorry. The lawyers kind of got into the middle of this because they see this as a kind of gambit, because Jones has repeatedly said that he's apologized to the parents, but this has always been a backhanded apology, bookended by another charge against them for being actors or what have you.
I mean, the fact that they have to be in the same room with this person and touch his hand, you know, the fact they're willing to touch his hand to shake it when he reaches out to them, it says a lot about them, but it says really nothing about, I mean, Alex Jones has said all there is to say about him. He has shown himself to be who he is. In testimony, can you just talk about what Neil Heslin, Jesse's father, says about the violent threats that he has faced?
Yeah, so Neil has said that people have confronted him on the street. He's gotten anonymous phone calls. But most alarming in his testimony today was the fact that, and I had this in my book as well, that someone fired a gun into his house. Today, he further testified that this spring, someone drove by the house in a car, yelled Alex Jones, and he could hear the sound of gunfire. So for him, this is far beyond some kind of online harassment. It's a very real threat. And Scarlett spoke to the fear that sort of stalks them ever since the shooting.
But I mean, the fact that any grieving parent who has lost a little child has to have a second of their life thinking about this sick crap that this person spreads, it breaks my heart that a grieving parent has to go through this. No part of their mind should ever be occupied with the existence of this person. Jones took the stand today. I know the topic of his company filing for bankruptcy came up. I mean, does he just shield, how does he shield his money, or does he?
He has a web of LLCs in which he has, you know, got a sort of shell game, it appears to be going.
LLCs are limited liability corporations.
Correct, yes. And lawyers for the families say that he's been shifting money around. They think that the bankruptcy filing is a pure gambit. He tried to say before the jurors, in fact, he did say that he was bankrupt. That is false. He has filed for bankruptcy, and that is still being adjudicated. He has also tried to submit that he tried to apologize, or that he was fully compliant in the run-up to these trials. In fact, the reason he's on trial for damages is because he had such utter disregard for the judicial system that he was defaulted in all of these cases. He lost the defamation cases because he refused to comply. But he keeps attempting to relitigate these cases when, in fact, he's already been found liable, and these trials are just for how much he must pay these families.
And so it's fascinating to see him in court with all the bluster and bravado he has on his, internet show, to see him, trying to apologize, such as it is to these parents in order to just kind of, lessen the verdict. What's expected to happen tomorrow?
So tomorrow he will continue to testify. But I have to say, and I really want to make sure that people understand this, this was a singularly powerful moment for Scarlett Lewis in particular. I mean, he was squirming in his chair, and she would not let him look down or fidget. She was addressing him directly. And one of the things she said was, "Alex, I want you to hear this." She wasn't angry. She actually was compassionate, and that was even more powerful. I mean, the room was really riveted, and he was extremely uncomfortable. It was an accident of scheduling that he was even there while she was still testifying, and it was quite a moment.
Well, I mean, it's extraordinary the grace and strength that she has to be able to as we see right now, just talk directly to this person who has spread unbelievable things. Elizabeth Williamson, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Anderson.
Coming up, we're going to check back in with John King, Magic Wall. More primary results coming in and more expected at the top of the hour when some Arizona polls close. The latest next. Polls are beginning to close in Arizona in a few minutes, and more results coming in from Kansas, Missouri, and Michigan. Want to check back in with John King of the Magic Wall. So polls start closing soon in Arizona. How big of a message could the state's GOP gubernatorial primary possibly send to the rest of the Republican Party?
Well, the question, Anderson, how deep, as we await the results and the polls closing, how deep is this cancer of supporting the big lie, saying elections are rigged, in the Republican bloodstream? Carrie Lake is the Trump-endorsed candidate there who has said if she loses this primary tonight, it's because there's cheating. Who does that sound like? So how deep is it in the Republican Party in Arizona? Not only in this race for governor, this is Trump versus Mike Pence, Trump versus the Republican establishment. How deep is it in the race for governor? Or will Arizona Republicans tonight possibly nominate an entire statewide slate of candidates who back the big lie? Or will the Republican Party finally say enough and move on? That's the big question in Arizona.
It's incredible that she says there's cheating. If she loses, of course, I assume, as you said earlier, I think if she wins, no cheating.
It's funny how that works.
Yeah. What new information about results in Missouri and Michigan do you have?
So let's go to Michigan first because you have the governor's map up. Tudor Dixon, who Donald Trump did endorse at the last minute, she previously had the endorsement of a very prominent Republican in the state, Betsy DeVos, the well-financed DeVos family. She is leading early on, about 11% of the vote counted, but she has a healthy early lead. And if you notice, looking at the map, the yellow, every county that has reported votes so far, Tudor Dixon is leading. Got a ways to go yet, but that's an encouraging sign clearly for Dixon there. She would face the Democratic incumbent, Gretchen Whitmer, if she is the nominee. And we switch to that Senate race in Missouri, and you see purple on the map right now. That is the Attorney General, Eric Schmidt, one of the two Erics, if you will. Donald Trump said he completely endorsed, totally endorsed Eric. Is it Eric Schmidt or is it Eric Greitens? Eric Schmidt is leading right now with 40% of the vote. Eric Greitens running a distant third, the former governor. Again, this is only about 3% of the vote right now. Vicky Hartzler, Republican congresswoman, is second at the moment. I just want to note, Anderson, as you watch the map fill in, you see her support out here in the west central part of the state. That's her current congressional district. So Vicky Hartzler, not all of these counties. As you move further east, these are outside of her district. But these counties right in here are Vicky Hartzler's congressional district. So not a surprise. She's running strong there, but a long way to go.
John, do you know like every county in every state?
Not everyone, but, you know, 3,000 plus. They're worth studying. America's a great place.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, the fact that you remember all this is incredible to me. So Kansas voters weighing in on a proposed state constitutional amendment on abortion. We talked about it earlier in the program. Any sense of how close that may be?
In some ways, this might be the most interesting thing tonight. Democrats have a theory that because of the Supreme Court decision, suburban Republicans will come home to Democrats this year. They don't want to support Republicans. So is that the case? And the Democrats will come out of the woodwork to vote. No, if you want to change the Kansas Constitution and allow the legislature to ban abortion, then you're voting yes. If you want to keep Kansas Constitution in place right now, which guarantees at least a basic right to an abortion, you vote no. No is leading at the moment. Again, only 8% of the voting, but that's a pretty big lead out of the minute. So what is the turnout here? You heard me say earlier, Anderson, the suburbs, Manhattan, Topeka, Kansas City, Kansas. This is suburban parts right here in the state. At the moment, those who support abortion rights are leading in the state of Kansas. A lot of votes to count.
Yeah, John King, appreciate it. Thanks. We'll be right back. News continues. Let's hand over to Laura Coates and CNN Tonight. Laura?
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.